Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today, Speaking in Maine takes us to Olin Arts Center Concert Hall on the campus of Bates College to hear U.S. Senator Angus King deliver a speech entitled How Washington Works or Doesn't to open the Bates College Annual Civic Forum Series. Bates College Civic Forums are produced and sponsored by Bates Harward Center for Community Partnerships. The series invites college and community audiences to contemplate civic, political, and policy issues significant to Maine and beyond. This program could be heard on our website, mpbn.net, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast.
Good evening. I'm Peggy Rotundo from the Bates College Harward Center for Community Partnerships, and I want to welcome all of you to the first of the Harward Center's Civic Forum series. The Civic Forum series explores civic, political, and policy issues that are significant to the Bates community, Maine, and beyond. We're delighted to have Senator Angus King here tonight to kick off the series and are pleased to have the Bates Politics Department as a co-sponsor of the event tonight. It's always an honor to have Senator King in the Lewiston-Auburn community and a special honor to welcome him back to the Bates campus. As most of you know, Senator King started his professional career in Maine with Pine Tree Legal Assistance in Skowhegan. He worked on Capitol Hill in the office of Maine's U.S. Senator William Hathaway as the chief counsel of the U.S. Senate Committee on Alcohol and Narcotics, returning to Maine to practice law and involve himself in various business ventures dealing with alternative energy and the development of large-scale energy conservation initiatives. In 1992, Senator King was elected governor of Maine and re-elected governor in 1996 with one of the largest majorities in the history of Maine. After serving as governor, he, among other things, taught a very popular course on leadership at Bates for two semesters, and in 2013 was elected Maine's first U.S. Senator, independent U.S. Senator, I should say. Senator King is well known for the keen intelligence, thoughtfulness, and heart he brings to all policy issues. We're grateful to Senator King for the example he continues to set for all of us as a steadfast believer in the need for greater bipartisan dialogue and relationship building among legislators. We're honored to have Senator King here tonight to talk on the topic of how Washington works or doesn't. Welcome, Senator King.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, part of the quiz is, this is a college, right? Part of the quiz is that you're gonna have to figure out how all these people are gonna work themselves into my talk tonight. I'm gonna start with Peggy. Peggy Rotundo is a model public servant, and I travel a lot. I don't say that all that often. In fact, in my experience, she's one of the best legislators that I've encountered in an appalling 40 years of hanging around Maine politics. And Peggy is a real asset. The other thing that's sort of daunting about being here is to be here at Bates, the alma mater of Edmund Muskie, one of the truly great legislators of the 20th century. And it was shocking to me the other day because Mary and I were hiking and somehow we met up with some younger people from Maine and I said something about Ed Muskie. They'd never heard of him, which was just astonishing to me because anybody that has any interest in the environment owes a huge amount to Ed Muskie. He literally invented the environmental protection movement. It's hard to believe, but there was no real federal legislation involving the environment whatsoever. No EPA, no Clean Air Act, no Clean Water Act, until Muskie was chairman of the Public Works Committee and wrote and pushed through the first Clean Air Act. And here's an amazing thing about Muskie, and it touches on what I'm gonna be talking about tonight. The Clean Air Act, the first major piece of national environmental legislation, which was a very important, controversial, touching every business in the country, many of the great businesses. The Clean Air Act passed the United States Senate unanimously. Isn't that astonishing? Today, we couldn't pass the time of day unanimously. And it's a tribute to Muskie's skill as a legislator, but it also touches upon what's different today than it was 45 or 50 years ago. So, and I've got to tell you one funny Muskie story. Peggy mentioned that I worked for Bill Hathaway, who was the other senator from Maine at the time. And one morning, Monday morning, Mr. Hathaway called. I was in Washington. He was in Maine. He said, "I'm flying in. I'll be there a little after 12. There's an important vote on an education amendment, and I'd like you to meet me in the Senate reception room to brief me on this amendment. So, to help me on the vote." I said, "Fine." So I went over to the reception room, and I'm sitting there, and sure enough, the bells are ringing, the vote's going on, and Hathaway comes barging through the door into this beautiful, ornate reception room, and right behind him is Muskie. I didn't bargain on Muskie. I thought it was just Hathaway. So Hathaway came up to me, as was our custom, and said, "So Angus, tell me about the amendment." And I said, "Well, on this hand, it does this, this, and this, and on the other hand, it does this." And I was describing, the pros and cons. And Muskie's behind Hathaway like this, sort of shifting from one foot to the other. And finally, he can't stand it anymore. And he physically grabs Hathaway, pushes him out of the way. And Muskie was the most imposing physical figure. He looked sort of like John Kerry. His face was about this long. And he got right down in my face and said, "I don't give a damn about all that. I want to know how to vote, and you better be right." It was the closest, I won't say it on the radio, but let me just say it was a terrifying moment for a 28-year-old. But Muskie was really a giant. Okay, what are we going to talk about tonight? I want to start with government. To understand where we are today, you've got to understand where we've been and how we got where we are. And the first thing to ask yourself is, why do we have a government at all? Why are there any governments? Why have there been governments from time immemorial? Why did the Israelites have a government, and the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Pharaohs? Why government at all? The answer is two things. Well, one word and two aspects. The word is security. Governments are set up fundamentally to keep people safe. To keep people safe from each other, or to keep people safe from other people outside that want to kill you. So the fundamental purpose of any government in any time, any place throughout history is security. And indeed, our Declaration of Independence starts out, and it very interestingly uses the word secure. Here's Jefferson. "All men," excuse me, he meant all men and women. His pen was running out of ink, so he just... "All men are created equal." A startling concept in 1775. "And are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights." Often it's done improperly. People say inalienable. It's not. It's unalienable. That means you can't even give it away. You can't even give away those rights, and they certainly can't be taken from you. "And among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And then the next paragraph, he says that to secure these rights, there's the word, secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That was a radical notion. So that's the Declaration of Independence. Flash forward 15 years, 10 years, to our Constitution, actually 12 years. And the preamble to the Constitution, which tells you what it's all about, uses two phrases that are the same. It's the same deal. To provide for the common defense and to ensure domestic tranquility. Both of those are, that's the two aspects of security. Domestic tranquility is so Al Capone can't rob you, and provide for the common defense is so Hitler can't take over New York. So that's the fundamental purpose. We create governments to protect us. But here's the problem. In order for the government to protect you, for example, from Hitler, you need an army, right? And an army is a manifestation of power. We give power to the government to protect us. We give power to the police, power to arrest, to put us in jail. We give power to the government to protect us. But here's the problem. How do we be sure we're protected from the government that we've created? Do you see, that's the ancient dilemma of all governments, is you give power to this central authority in order to protect you, but then you have to be protected from the government that you've created. The saying in Latin is, quis custodes ipsos custodiat. Quis custodes ipso custodiat. It means, who will guard the guardians? That's the fundamental question of all political science. Who will guard the guardians? And by the way, I always like to share a bit of knowledge that you can take home, and I've just given you a nice Latin phrase. This is a university. Are your diplomas still in Latin? Anybody know? Yes, I bet they are. They're still in Latin. Anyway, here's another phrase that you might be interested in. It's the Greek origin of the word politics. Comes from the word poly, meaning many, and ticks, meaning small blood-sucking insects. So, politics. So, there you have it. See, I always like people to be able to walk away with some fact. Juvenal was a Roman poet who used that term, quis custodiat, and actually he was talking about who will protect the chastity of the wife from the guardians who are set up to protect the wife, but it's come to be attributed to Plato, who never said it, but the concept is there. Okay, why is it necessary to protect people from their own government? A guy in the 1800s in England named Acton, A-C-T-O-N, Lord Acton, said the most profound thing about power that's ever been said. He said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's true throughout history. If you give people power, they will be corrupted by it. It's inevitable, and that's part of the human condition. It's part of human nature. And so, how do we've established that we need power, who will guard us, and that we need to be guarded because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The people that wrote our Constitution were geniuses. And the reason they were geniuses was that they had a deep understanding of human nature. That's what it was all about. They understood what we're talking about here. And James Madison put it in an absolutely brilliant way in the 51st Federalist. He said, we're gonna give this power to this central government because they have to protect us, but we have to set ambition against ambition. John Boehner and Barack Obama, Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid. I mean, ambition against ambition. That's Madison's phrase. But then he really had a wonderful phrase to go to the next, further on in the 51st Federalist, and I've got to read this to you because I don't want to get it wrong. And it's in my phone under notes. Here's what Madison said. And again, I apologize for the gender thing. He just talks about men, but you know, this is genius. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. in framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, however, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. I don't know if we have any political science professors in the audience. I don't want to insult you, but that's all you need to know about political science. That's it. You now have a PhD. I'm a senator. I can do this. But you see what if you must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Okay. Our Constitution is the best answer ever provided so far in human history to that question. How do you give the government sufficient power to protect people and do the things that it has to do, and at the same time, oblige it to control itself? And I'm going to give you a little demonstration of how the Constitution did that. What the Constitution does, essentially, is divide power up. Divide power up. This is a cucumber. But don't think of it as any ordinary cucumber. This is actually George III. Unified power. All the power is in this cucumber, okay? This homely Vegematic is the Constitution. So what happens when you take all the power and put it through the Constitution? I guarantee you're going to remember this. Do you see what happened? It split it all up into pieces. It took all the power that was in that one place, concentrated, and divided it up. It put some in the federal government, some in the state government, some in the town. In the federal government, it put some in the Congress, some in the Supreme Court, some in the presidency, House and Senate. In the legislature, in the judicial, it has divided it up, divided power up between the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury. Do you see what I mean? You have this bundle of power, and it's all divided up. That's the answer that our Constitution provides to this ancient question. So you've got all of these divisions, and then internal divisions, and then they did something really interesting. They had this elaborate scheme to divide power so ambition would check ambition and nobody would be able to take all the power. But then they said, even if this thing really works like a clock and somebody gets a hold of the machinery of power and we have one party that controls the Congress and the judiciary and the presidency, there's still a danger. So then they passed the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights are simply, I think of it as a cone of protection around each individual. That no matter whether the government follows all the procedures, everything they do is right, they can't abridge your freedom of speech. They can't tell you what religion you have to preach. They can't take your gun away. They can't rob you. They can't search your papers in your house without a warrant. And by the way, the Fourth Amendment is again an indication of what geniuses they were. They could have said, searches and seizures are illegal. You know, we don't like searches and seizures. We don't want the government rummaging around in your papers. They didn't say that. They said unreasonable searches and seizures, which left the government the power to search, but only if you could convince a neutral judge that you had a right, a reason to do so. So you see, they're just checks and checks and checks within checks. So that's the way our system has been designed. Okay. So what does this all have to do with today? Well, one of the fundamental questions at the time of the adoption of the Constitution is the same question we're debating today. And the question was, how much power would the federal government have versus state, local, and individual? Do you see what I mean? At the time of the Constitution, that was a very hot question, and the debates in the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia were all about how do we allocate power? Because those people had two experiences in their heads at the time. Experience one was George III. Absolute power. They didn't like that. But experience two was the Articles of Confederation. We all think of the United States being born at the time of the Revolutionary War. The United States really wasn't born for some years after, you know, the Declaration of Independence, 1776. The Constitution wasn't adopted till 1787, 11 years later. So they had this experience of the Articles of Confederation, which were too weak. They didn't give enough power to the central government. They needed more power, but not too much. And that was the Constitution. By the way, it's a great principle of our time of open meetings, transparency, sunshine. Nobody, you know, can be kept out of a meeting. No closed markups. At the Constitutional Convention, they nailed the windows shut so nobody could hear what they were doing. Isn't that interesting? I've often wondered if CNN was in that hall, or Fox, would we have gotten a Constitution? Would we have had the debate that they had in order to arrive where they did? And of course, you know, they almost broke down on a couple of issues. One was slavery. I'm not going to dwell on that, but slavery is in the Constitution in a variety of ways. And I criticize my colleagues sometimes for avoiding things. That's what Congress does, by the way, right now really well. That's our real skill, is avoiding things, paying bills, building highways, climate change, we're avoiding. Here's something interesting. The Constitution outlawed the slave trade. 20 years later. It outlawed the slave trade, I think, 1807 or 1809. In other words, they avoided it. And there were other ways they avoided it. But the other major issue that they had was, how do we balance the interests of small states and large states? And that's what really almost broke them up. They could not get there. Because the larger states wanted the Congress to be based on population. Therefore, New York would have a lot of representatives and little old Delaware wouldn't have very many. The smaller states wanted the legislature to be based upon states. So Delaware would have a vote and New York would have a vote. They were just dead in the water on this issue. They almost broke up and went home. And a guy named Roger Sherman from Connecticut came up with the idea of creating one body based on population and one body based on states. The U.S. Senate. It's preposterous, if you think about it, that Maine has the same number of senators as California. I think it's wonderful. This is sort of a little sub-point. The whole structure of the United States government was based on a compromise. It was called the Great Compromise. We're going to talk about that word a little bit later. Okay, so number one, this issue that we're debating now, the Tea Party and the role of the federal government, has come up in my brief research about at least 10 times in American history, and I'm not going to dwell on them, but number one was the writing of the Constitution itself. Number two was the adoption of the Constitution. That's when they had to do the Federalist Papers and explain to people, don't worry, we're creating the central government, but it's got all these controls and ambition controlling ambition, and it won't be all that bad, enumerated powers, limited, don't worry. So that was an issue. Then in 1828, there was a tariff imposed by Washington, and the South Carolina didn't like it, and they wanted to nullify it and say, anything Washington does that we don't like, we don't have to abide by. That was avoided by Jackson's election, and they sort of slid by that issue. In the 1850s, they had the Fugitive Slave Law, which the northern states didn't like. Congress passed a law that said if a slave escapes into a free territory, the legal process in that territory has to give him or her back to his master. The northern states didn't like that. They said, we're not going to enforce that law. We're going to nullify that law. In fact, there's a decision of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin that said that law is of no effect here in Wisconsin. So that's an interesting case where it was states' rights in a what we would deem a progressive way. Then, of course, the Civil War. The Civil War was ultimately about this question. It was ultimately about slavery. Let's not kid ourselves. Anybody that tells you the Civil War wasn't about slavery, Google South Carolina secession resolution, because it mentioned slavery about 10 times. I mean, it was states' rights to have slavery. I mean, that's what it was. But it was in the context of the right of the state versus the right of the federal government. And that's where Lee is very interesting. Robert E. Lee, I don't know if you know this, Lincoln offered Lee command of the Union Army at the beginning of the Civil War. Very interesting. Lee was the preeminent soldier in America at that time. Lincoln offered him the command of the Union Army. Lee went off to Arlington for about 3 days and agonized. And Lee really agonized. Lee was an extraordinary man, the only man ever to go through West Point without a single demerit. My father used to tell me that Lee, who was an Episcopalian, never took communion because he didn't feel worthy. He had taken an oath at the time of joining the Army at West Point, and he had to break that oath, which was very hard for him. But here's what Lee said in making that decision after Lincoln offered him this position. Lee said, "I cannot take up arms against my country." Doesn't that sound a little odd? Virginia was his country. He thought of Virginia as his country, not the United States. And a fascinating bit of history is that at the time of the Civil War and before, the United States was a plural noun. They, the United States, the United States are going to do thus and so. They are going to do thus and so. After the Civil War, the United States became a singular noun, which we think of as today. The United States is going to do thus and so. No law was changed, but it's hard for us to understand the mindset that these were different countries. And Lee said, "I cannot take up arms against my country." Okay, the progressive era of Teddy Roosevelt tested this question of how strong could the federal government be versus states, local localities, and individuals. And during this period, going back into the 1830s and the time of the 1828 tariff, there was a guy named John C. Calhoun from South Carolina who came up with some words that you hear today. Nullification, interposition, secession. I've seen speeches by members of the Tea Party that talk about nullification. Now, if you Google it, there's a song called Nullify Now. And it goes right back, and what nullification means is if the federal government passes a law that we don't like in Maine, we can nullify it. We can pass a law here that nullifies it. And in fact, the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1800, passed by John Adams, Jefferson, who was not yet president, secretly wrote a resolution of nullification for the Kentucky legislature. Isn't that fascinating? Jefferson was a small government guy until he became president and decided he wanted to buy Louisiana. That was a different deal. That's nowhere in the Constitution. But nullification and interposition, and those are all terms that we hear today in the discussion that we're involved with. The New Deal. Lots of discussion about what is the power of the federal government, and the Supreme Court at first said, you can't do these things. They passed all these New Deal bills to regulate a lot of things to try to bring the economy back. The Supreme Court said no. And then President Roosevelt talked about packing the Supreme Court and changing the composition of the court. And miraculously, shortly thereafter, the Supreme Court changed their mind and said, well, we think maybe you can do this. And that's known as the switch in time that saved nine. In the famous sick chicken case. And then, you're now into my lifetime, came the civil rights movement of the 60s. Exactly the same rhetoric, exactly the same arguments, exactly the same position. States' rights. States' rights. The federal government has no right to impose on the people of Alabama to change our culture and customs. There's a famous clip of George Wallace saying, segregation now, segregation forever. And then he talks about the heel of federal tyranny on the neck does not fit well on the neck of the people of Alabama. So it was exactly what I'm trying to give you here is what we're going through is nothing new. This is an argument we've been having in this country for 200 years. One of my favorite quotes from Mark Twain, I forgot to put him on here, and there are lots of them, is, history doesn't always repeat itself, but it usually rhymes. Isn't that marvelous? History doesn't always repeat itself, but it usually rhymes, and it's been rhyming about every 40 years for the past 200 years as we're struggling to find where this balance is. Okay, so that gets us pretty close to where we are now with the Tea Party. How is this period that we're in now different from all these other ones that I mentioned? And it's similar in a lot of ways. A lot of the rhetoric is the same. A lot of the impulse is the same. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with this argument. My dissertation here is not saying the federal government should have all the power. I don't believe that. As a former governor, I don't believe that. I believe there are things better left to the states, and that there is a division of power, and that the 10th Amendment does have vitality. So I'm not arguing that there's a right answer. I don't think there is. I think it's something that we're always sort of working with and trying to find the right balance. So one difference I find today is this isn't as much a regional issue as it has been traditionally. Traditionally, it was the South in many of these cases that I mentioned, the tariff case, the civil rights case, the Civil War. It's more of a national issue, although there is still a great deal of concentration in the South. Here's another interesting thing that occurred to me. It's not based upon a particular issue, but on a more general feeling of distrust and hostility toward the federal government. It's not slavery. It's not tariffs. It's not regulation of the economy. It's not a particular issue, but it is a kind of widespread distrust and discomfort and a kind of feeling that the federal government is going too far. There's an antipathy. Now, here's one of the things that occurred to me just recently that validates that point. We are now about to have our third threatened shutdown in 3 years. The interesting thing is, each one of them has been for a different reason. In 2013, we actually had a shutdown. Anybody remember why? Defund the Affordable Care Act. Remember that? Defund, we got to defund the Affordable Care Act. We're going to shut the government down. And we did. I didn't, but it happened. The Affordable Care Act. In 2014, at the end of the year, we had another threatened shutdown about immigration and the president's orders on immigration. Now we're about to have a threatened shutdown on Planned Parenthood. The point to me is that this isn't about immigration, the Affordable Care Act, or Planned Parenthood. This is about a more deep feeling about being imposed upon by the federal government, rightly or wrongly. I think that's another difference from historically. Now, here's my point. It's taken me a while, hasn't it? But here's something that's I think very important and very bothersome. We're used to arguing about issues and working on issues and having different points of view about issues, whatever it is. Whatever the issue is, whether it's immigration or guns or you know, slavery 150 years ago or some other, arguing about issues. And people vote for candidates according to, at least in part, how they feel about those issues. He's with me on immigration, so I'm voting with him. She's with me on early childhood education, I'm voting for her on issues. Here's what's troubling now and what I see in the Congress. We've now got a sizable number of people for whom, and I'm talking about the public, not necessarily the representatives, for whom trying to work out one of those problems is itself a political offense. That's really scary. I have a very good friend, a very conservative senator, who was in a was facing a primary 2 years ago, and I had dinner with him about a year before his primary, and he's very conservative, Republican. I said, what in the world are they going to charge you with? You're one of the most conservative people here. Nobody can get to your right. He said, they're going to charge me with being reasonable. Let that sink in for a minute. If being reasonable is an offense that leads you to lose an election, this country is in trouble. Because you can't solve problems if people fear even talking about solutions. And that's a real, I'm not making this up. I have friends in the House from some of these very conservative districts. And by the way, this can work both ways. But either party, it can work both ways. But right now it's happening in the Republican Party. But my friend said, you know, I can't be seen talking to you. I can't be seen trying to solve this problem, because that will be what they'll run against me. That was Boehner. You know, Boehner made deals with Obama. He's got to go. I'm not making this up. I read the quote from an anonymous congressman who said, he said, I spend most of my time in Washington trying to convince people I'm not crazy, and I spend most of my time in my district trying to convince my constituents I am crazy. Think about that for a minute. But we've created this situation where compromise is a dirty word, and yet compromise is the essence of any human situation. Mary and I compromise every day. It usually consists of my saying yes. But we all compromise all the time. That's how we get along as human beings. And to say in a political situation that you can't compromise is, it just renders the whole system, the whole constitutional system breaks down if people can't talk to each other and try to solve problems. I find this really disturbing. And this is new. This is new. I've never heard of a period like this where people are I've never heard where people are pilloried for association and thinking. My friend Joe Manchin from West Virginia calls this guilt by conversation. And I remember I got to know Margaret Chase Smith, who was a wonderful, famous Maine senator from the mid of the mid-20th century. And I got to know her. Channel 10 of Public Broadcasting asked me to do a documentary about her, and I went up, and my friend Bill Hathaway beat her in 1972. So I went up and spent a day with her to prepare to do this documentary, and I went home and I said, Mary, I feel sort of guilty about this because I work for Bill Hathaway, and I'm afraid if she finds that out, she's going to think, you know, I was not honest with her. So I wrote her a letter. Dear Senator Smith, I just felt before we went any further with this project, you should know that I work for Mr. Hathaway. And she wrote me back a classic Margaret J. Smith letter. Dear Angus King, she always used both your names. Dear Angus King, it is perfectly all right with me that you once worked for Mr. Hathaway. Yours sincerely, Margaret J. Smith. That was it. The legend was that she was also famous for somebody wrote her a very intemperate letter, and supposedly she wrote him back and said, Dear Mr. Smith, or Dear Mr. Jones, you should know that some fool is writing letters using your name. I don't know if she really did it, but it's possible. So this idea that compromise is an offense is really a problem. And here's a note from a fellow, a quote from a guy named Tom Cole, who is a Republican member of the House. And he's talking, this was just in today's paper, he's talking about Paul Ryan as being talked about for Speaker of the House. You've probably heard that. And Paul Ryan is being attacked from the right as not sufficiently conservative. And this is what Tom Cole says, who's a pretty conservative guy himself. When you're a Republican congressman from Oklahoma, you're not exactly a liberal. Tom Cole says, Paul Ryan has played a major role in advancing the conservative cause and creating the Republican House majority. Listen to this. His critics are not true conservatives. They are radical populists who neither understand nor accept the institutions, procedures, and traditions that are the basis of constitutional governance. That's a pretty devastating critique. And that's from a Republican congressman. So whenever you hear somebody saying, I'm not going to compromise, what they're really saying is, I'm 100% right. And nobody is 100% right. But as soon as somebody says that, then the wheels of government won't function. We cannot possibly get anything done. Okay. I've got you pretty depressed by now, I trust. Here's another problem with the current situation. Our system, remember all these pieces? This is, oh, look, it's the Senate. How are they going to deal with that on the radio is what I want to know. Our system is designed to frustrate radical change. It's designed that they didn't want things to be able to happen quickly. They wanted a system that was cumbersome, slow, difficult, complicated, and they succeeded beyond their wildest imagination. So, but imagine you're in the Congress, you come to change things, and yet this system doesn't work. Those nasty Democrats in the Senate, you know, they're filibustering. That president vetoes it. It takes 67 votes. That pesky Constitution says 67 votes. We don't have them. They're mad as hell. And their constituents are very mad because they've told their constituents they can fix all this stuff. And that's where John Boehner comes in. He used the term a week or so ago, these people are false prophets. I thought that was an interesting term. Because they've led their constituents to believe that if you send me to Washington, I'll fix it. We'll repeal the Affordable Care Act. The problem is they didn't have the votes. And that leads to even greater frustration. If we can't fix it, they told us we could fix it. It's even worse than we thought. And people get madder and madder. It's sort of a spiral of anger. And again, you get to the place where people can't talk to each other. And the only time I can recall, and I mentioned Margaret Chase Smith, she told me that during the McCarthy era, McCarthy was a senator from Wisconsin who called everybody communists, who said there were communists in the government, and it was a terrible, dark period. And she told me herself that people in the Senate were actually afraid of who they had lunch with in the Senate dining room because McCarthy could use it against them. Think of that. To be afraid of who you were sitting with, that it would somehow come against you politically. And by the way, she was the brave person who first called McCarthy out in the famous Declaration of Conscience. Okay. Here's the other interesting thing. All of this gridlock that we're dealing with is being generated by about 50 people. The Freedom Caucus in the House is about 50 members. The total Congress is 535. So it's an interesting phenomenon, and I guess it's a tribute to the framers that 50 people can gum it up. It's all it takes. But we're not talking about a majority of the House or a majority of the Senate. Okay, how'd we get here? We're closing in on this, guys. Be patient. What has contributed to this? Money is a part of it. I don't think we generally realize the qualitative change in political campaign financing that has occurred in the last 5 or 6 years. It used to be that when you ran for office, you raised money, your opponent raised money, and you duked it out, okay? King raises a couple of million, Summers raises a couple of million, and that's the fight, okay? By the way, a friend in Washington called me during the campaign in 12 and said, "How much is your budget for your campaign?" I said, $3 million. He said, "What a quaint number." But now, the money that's raised by the candidate is almost irrelevant because somebody can come in with $20 million just like that. In Montana, which has a lower population than Maine, the last election they spent $35 million against John Tester. In it comes. And I think this is really disturbing. We've got this elaborate system of campaign finance where if you give me a contribution for $100, I have to report it, when you gave it, your name, your occupation, your address. But somebody else can come in and give me or my opponent on their behalf $5 million, and it's a whole secret. Nobody knows who it is. Nobody knows where the money's coming from. And this is the fruits of several recent Supreme Court opinions. Anthony Kennedy, in the Citizens United opinion, wrote one of the truly humorous lines in all of judicial history. It would be uproarious if it weren't so sad. He said, I'm not going to give you the exact quote, but pretty close, independent expenditures create neither the appearance nor the actuality of a quid pro quo. Come on. Somebody comes in and spends $5 million on your behalf or spends $5 million against you and you oh, that's nice. I mean, that just doesn't pass the straight face test. And yet that's the premise upon which the Citizens United case rests. That one premise that there's no quid pro quo created because they're not giving the money directly to you, they're giving it to her, and then she spends it against you. That's the premise of Citizens United. Okay, so money is a big deal. Story in the paper this weekend. I couldn't believe it. The New York Times did a very detailed study of all the money that's been spent so far in the presidential campaign by all the candidates. More than 50% of all the money spent in this year's presidential campaign by all candidates was contributed by 158 American families. Think about that for a second. 158 families have contributed more than 50% of the money in the presidential campaign thus far. The Koch brothers, Charles and David, have already announced they're going to spend $889 million in this election year, in 2016. Almost $1 billion. And a lot of it, people won't know where it's coming from. They have these organizations. John McCain referred to them as identity laundering organizations. So you don't know where it's coming from. So one of the reasons that we're in this fix is money. The other one is what I call the balkanization of the news business. When I was a kid, when I was a young adult, everybody got their news from one person. Anybody know who it was? Walter Cronkite. Isn't it amazing? Everybody above a certain age knows that anyway. But now the news comes from everywhere, and you know what? It's human nature to read or watch the news source that you agree with. So people who tend to be conservative watch Fox News. People who tend to be liberal watch MSNBC. People who can't make up their mind watch CNN. There's a term called confirmation bias. You get the information that already sort of matches your point of view, and that's a change, and that means people are being pushed from one side or the other. If you read Daily Kos every day for a year, I guarantee you'll be a liberal at the end of it. And if you read the Drudge Report, chances are you'll be pretty conservative. And that is one of the things that has pulled us apart. The internet is something that has done this as well, because people are now being able to communicate with each other in ways they never could before. There's always been an anti-immigrant constituency in this country. In New York, in the 1890s, there were little signs in the windows of stores that said N-I-N-A. It said that meant no Irish need apply. So anti-immigrant sentiment is nothing new. It goes back to the 1840s, to there was a whole political party, the Know-Nothing Party. No Catholics, no immigrants. But the difference is now we have the internet, and all the people that feel this way have formed a sort of critical mass and become a political movement. Religion is involved in this in ways that it wasn't before. When we talk about regulating the economy during the 30s, or the Tariff of 1832, or slavery, or the Alien and Sedition Acts, all of those are kind of political issues. You know, normal political, social, economic issues. Now we've got abortion, gay rights, Planned Parenthood. We've got, and religion is part of this discussion as well, which historically was not so much a part of the political discussion in this country. Rapid change, economic, demographic. Here's one that I think is one of the biggest causes of the problem, and this works both ways, both parties, is gerrymandering. The idea that you have a district that's either all Democratic or all Republican, and if you're in a Republican district, if you get the nomination and have a pulse, you're going to win. Same in the Democratic district. That tends to pull people apart. Because if the real election is the Republican primary, then it's going to be an effort to get further and further to the right. If in the Democratic district it's all Democratic, we saw it somewhat last night. Those candidates last night took some positions that could be hard for them in the general election, because they were playing to the Democratic base in the Democratic primaries coming up in Iowa and New Hampshire and others. So gerrymandering is the one-party districts. Low turnouts in primaries is another factor. A typical primary in this country gets maybe 20% turnout. The year I ran for Senate, the Democratic primary had 9% turnout, the Republican had 13%. So if you do the math backwards, let's say if you have a 20% turnout and the winner of the primary gets 35%. You with me? Let me work it backwards. Republicans constitute, let's say, 30% of Maine, which is roughly true. So if 20% of the Republicans turn out, that's 6% of Maine, right? 20% of 30%. The person who wins with, say, 35%. So that's a third of 6%. You end up with 2% of the people of Maine selecting the Republican or the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate. And who votes in primaries? Activists, people who are more fired up, who are more engaged. So part of the solution is for all of us who are in parties, not me, but all the people who are in parties, participate. If you don't, you're handing the decision-making power over to a very small group. And then that's going to naturally push the candidates either to the right or the left. The other thing, and we're almost, I'm about to say finally. Mary says I say finally too much, it gets people's hopes up. One of the problems I see in Washington today is what I call messaging. When I worked there 40 years ago for Bill Hathaway, for a committee, I could swear, and it may be just my, you know, rosy nostalgia, but I don't think so. We spent about 80% of our time governing and 20% politics. Today, it's just the opposite. It's all politics. And we have votes, and it works both ways. You know, the Democrats will have a vote on the minimum wage that they know they won't get the votes for. They're not enough. The Republicans have power, but we're going to have a vote on the minimum wage. But it's not going to happen. But we do it anyway because it'll put the Republicans in a position of voting against the minimum wage. The House has voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act 54 times. It ain't going to happen as long as Barack Obama is president of the United States. It just isn't. So what was the 54 times? Can you imagine the time and effort that took to go through all the process to have those votes? On Iran, we had, I think, 3 or 4 virtually identical votes on the Iran deal because Mitch McConnell felt it would embarrass the Democrats to vote for it. And in the House on the Iran deal, for some reason they decided at the last minute, instead of running a resolution of disapproval, which the Republicans disapproved, they thought it would be better politics to run a resolution of approval and make the Democrats vote for it. Do you see what I'm saying? It's, in other words, it's purely political. And I don't mean to pick on the Republicans, but that's what's going on right now in the legislature. But the Democrats did the same thing. They ran bills when they were in the majority in the Senate that they knew weren't going to pass, but were more about messaging. So what do? Money, we at least require disclosure. The Supreme Court said we can. It's the one thing they said we can do. We should require, if people are going to put an ad on TV in Maine and says King is a socialist, at least you ought to know who it is. You're not allowed to go to a Maine town meeting with a bag over your head. You know, if you're going to make your argument, make your point, then at least we should know who's doing it. So disclosure is probably the only thing we can do. I talked about voting and increasing the turnout. I think we need to move in this country, and it's got to be done state by state, to independent reapportion commissions. So it isn't done politically. They do this, I think, in Iowa and California. It's worked quite well. Non-political, and instead of the battle of the computers where, you know, you're going to have a few more Republicans in this district and Democrats in this district, let's just do it in a more neutral way so you have more districts that are toss-ups. I think that will drive people toward the middle and toward solving problems. And then I guess I will say finally, value candidates who listen and try to find solutions rather than necessarily ones that agree with you all the time. And I want to end, I always like to end with Lincoln. You can't go wrong. And Lincoln wrote his first inaugural at a moment when he was hoping to still hold the Union together. Lincoln was elected in November. He was inaugurated in March. And in that period, 7 states seceded from the Union. James Buchanan, his predecessor, publicly said in the winter of 1860, "I am the last president of the United States," because he didn't think the Union could be maintained. Lincoln's first inaugural was a lengthy plea to the South to stay in the Union. And he closed it with some thoughts about how we need to focus on what binds us together rather than what pulls us apart. And here's how Lincoln ended his plea. "I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained it, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic chords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." When again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Thank you all.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. Today's Speaking in Maine took us to Olin Arts Center on the campus of Bates College to hear U.S. Senator Angus King deliver a speech entitled "How Washington Works or Doesn't" to open Bates College annual Civic Forum series. The program was edited for length, and the entire program This program was edited for length. Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast from our website, mpbn.net. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine. For MPBN Radio, I'm Jonathan Woodward.